and this is Ms. G, and I'm back with Left Hanging, and I have a great story for you tonight by Patrick McManus. It's called The Night the Bear Ate Goomba. There was so much confusion over the incident that I don't want to add to it by getting the sequences mixed up. First of all, and I remember this clearly, it was the summer after Crazy Eddie Muldoon and I had been sprung from third grade at Delmore Blight Grade School. The Muldoon's only good milk cow died that summer, shortly after the weasel got in the chicken house and killed most of the laying hens. This was just before the fertilizer company Mr. McDoon worked for went bankrupt and he lost his job. The engine on his tractor blew up a week later, so he couldn't harvest his crops, which were all pretty dried up from the drought anyway. Then Mr. Muldoon fell in the pit trap that Crazy Eddie and I had dug to capture wild animals. Our plan was to train the wild animals and then put on shows to earn a little extra money for the family. But Mr. Muldoon fell in the trap and afterwards made us shovel all the dirt back into it. The only wild animal we had trapped was a skunk. And when Mr. Muldoon fell in on top of it, he terrified the poor creature practically to death. Neither Mr. Muldoon nor the skunk was hurt much, but the skunk managed to escape during all the excitement. So there went our wild animal show. This occurred about midsummer, as I recall, about the time Mr. Muldoon's nerves got so bad that old Doc Hicks told him to stop drinking coffee, which apparently was what had brought on his nervous condition. For the rest of the summer, Mr. Muldoon gave off a faint, gradually fading odor of skunk, unless he got wet. Then the odor reconstituted itself to approximately its original power, which placed a major restraint on the Muldoon's social life, meager as that was. Fortunately, Mr. Muldoon didn't get wet that often, mainly because of the drought that had killed off his crops. As Mrs. Muldoon was fond of saying, every cloud has a silver lining. So far, it had been a fairly typical summer for Mr. Muldoon, but he claimed to be worried about a premonition that his luck was about to turn bad. Then Eddie's grandmother, Mrs. Muldoon's mother, showed up for a visit. "I knew it," Mr. Muldoon told a neighbor. "I knew something like this was about to happen. I must be physic." After I got to know Eddie's grandmother a little better, I could see why Mr. Muldoon regarded her visit as a stroke of bad luck. She immediately assumed command of the family and began to boss everyone around, including me. Nevertheless, I doubted that Mr. Muldoon was actually physic, because otherwise he would never have come up with the idea of the camping trip. "I'm worried about Pa," Eddie said one morning as he sat back on his porch. "He's not been himself lately." "Who's he been?" I asked, somewhat startled, although I regarded Mr. Muldoon as one of the oddest persons I knew. "Pa's just starting to act weird, that's all. You know, what crazy idea he came up with this morning? He says we all gotta go on a camping trip up in the mountains and pick huckleberries. He says we can sell any extra huckleberries we get for cash. But Pa don't know anything about camping. We don't even have any camping stuff. Ain't that strange?" "Yeah," I said. "Eddie, you don't suppose your pa, I tried to think of a delicate way to phrase it." "What?" Eddie said. "You don't suppose your pa, will let me go on the camping trip too, do you?" When Eddie put the question to his father, Mr. Muldoon tried to conceal his affection for me beneath a malevolent frown. "Oh, all right," he growled at me. "But no mischief. That means no knives, no hatchets, no matches, no slingshots, and no shovels. Understood?" Eddie and I laughed. It was good to see his father in a humorous mood once again. I rushed home and asked my mother if I could go camping with the Muldoons. "You'd be away from home a whole week," she said. "I'll have to think about that. Okay, you can go." I quickly packed my hatchet, knife, and slingshot along with edibles Mom gave me to contribute to the Muldoon grub box. The one major item I lacked was a sleeping bag. "I'll just make a bedroll out of some blankets off my bed," I informed my mother. "You most certainly won't," she informed me. "You'll use the coat." "Ah, gee, Ma, the coat's so stupid. Mr. Muldoon will tease me all during the trip if I have to use that stupid coat for a sleeping bag." The coat in question was a tattered, dog-chewed old fur of indeterminate species that my grandmother had acquired during a brief period of family wealth in the previous century. It had been given to me as a sleeping bag for my frequent but always aborted attempts at sleeping out alone in the yard. For all its hideous appearance, it was warm and cozy and covered my 9-year-old body nicely from end to end. Still, I knew the Muldoons would laugh themselves silly when they saw me bed down in a woman's fur coat. My only hope of retaining a shred of dignity, not to mention my carefully nursed macho image, was to slip into it after they had all gone to sleep. I stuffed the coat into a gunny sack, concealing it under the one threadbare blanket my mother reluctantly issued me. The day of the big camping trip dawned bright and clear, a common ruse of Mother Nature to lure unsuspecting souls out into the wilds. The five of us piled into the ancient Muldoon sedan and set off for the mountains. Most of our camping gear, such as it was, balanced precariously atop the car. It was wrapped in a huge hay tarp, which was to serve as our tent. "Ain't had a drop of rain in 3 months," Mr. Muldoon had said. "Probably won't need the tarp." This statement would later be recalled and admitted as evidence in the case against Mr. Muldoon's being physic. "How you doing back there, Goomba?" Mr. Muldoon said to Eddie's grandmother. For some reason, everyone called her Goomba. "How you think I'm doing?" Goomba snapped back. "Wedged in between these two sweaty youngins, I'm boiling in my own juice. This camping trip is the stupidest dang fool idea you ever come up with, Herbert. We'll probably all get it by bears." "Tell me, what about bears, Herbert?" "Yeah," I thought, "what about bears?" Mr. Muldoon laughed. "You don't have to worry about bears. They're more afraid of humans than we are of them." "Well," I thought, "that's certainly not true of all humans, particularly one that I know personally. It's probably not true of all bears, either." But I kept these thoughts to myself, since Goomba was doing a thorough job of grilling Mr. Muldoon on the subject. I could tell that the talk of bears was making Mrs. Muldoon nervous. Not that she was the only one. "Let's change the subject, Goomba," she said. "Oh, all right. How about mountain lions, Herbert?" For the rest of the long, hot, dusty ride up to the huckleberry patches, Goomba harangued Mr. Muldoon about every possible threat to our well-being, from bears to crazed woodcutters. By the time we reached our campsite, she had everyone in such a nervous state that we were almost afraid to get out of the car. Mr. Muldoon stepped out, swiveled his head about as though expecting an attack from any quarter, and then ordered us to help set up camp. No level area for our tent was immediately apparent, but Crazy Eddie and I finally located one. It was down a steep bank and on the far side of a little creek. Mr. Muldoon, Eddie, and I dragged the bundle of camp gear down the bank and across a log to the little clearing in the brush and trees. In no time at all, Mr. Muldoon had constructed a fine shelter out of the tarp. Eddie and I built a fire ring of rocks, and Mrs. Muldoon and Goomba got a fire going and put coffee on to boil, apparently forgetting that the doctor had told Mr. Muldoon to cut down on his coffee drinking because of his nerves. Eddie and I sampled the fishing in the creek. All in all, the camping trip showed signs of becoming a pleasant experience. Then it got dark. "I say, keep a fire going all night," Goomba advised. "It might help keep the bears off of us." "There ain't no bears," Mr. Muldoon said. "Now stop worrying about bears." "Ha! Bears are more afraid of us than we are of them. Now everybody get a good night's sleep. We got a lot of huckleberries to pick tomorrow." He stripped down to his long underwear and barreled into the pile of quilts and blankets Mrs. Muldoon had arranged on the ground. I pulled my threadbare blanket out of the gunny sack and spread it out in the dirt next to Goomba. "Good heavens, Patrick," Mrs. Muldoon said. "Is that all you have to sleep in, that one little blanket? The nights can get pretty chilly up here in the mountains." "Oh, I've got more blankets in my sack," I lied. "If it turns cold out, I'll just put some more on. But I sleep warm." As the night dragged on into its full depth, I lay there, shivering in my blanket, studying with considerable interest the looming dark shapes the full moon revealed around our camp. Finally, Goomba and the Muldoon ceased their thrashing about on the hard ground and began to emit the sounds of sleep. I jerked the fur coat out of the gammy sack and buttoned myself into its comforting warmth. I set a mental alarm to awaken before the Muldoon so I could conceal the coat before they caught sight of the hideous thing. Then I drifted off into fitful sleep. "What is that?" Goomba shouted in my ear. Later, she claimed only to be having a nightmare, but fortunately for us, she sounded the alarm just in time. In the silence that followed Goomba's shout, you could almost hear four pairs of eyelids popping open in the dark. "A bear!" Goomba shouted. "A bear's got me!" Since I was lying right next to Goomba, this announcement aroused my curiosity to no end. I tried to leap to my feet, but wrapped in the fur coat, could only manage to make it to all fours. "Bear!" screamed Crazy Eddie. "Bear's got goo!" "Bear!" shrieked Mrs. Muldoon. "There it is!" Goomba made a horrible sound. I could make out the big round whites of her eyes fixed on me in the darkness, no doubt pleading wordlessly with me for help. But what could a small boy do against a bear? "Holy bleep!" roared Mr. Muldoon. He lunged to his feet, knocking over the ridge pole and dropping the tarp on us and the bear. Figuring Goomba ready for a goner and myself next on the bear's menu, I tore out from under the tarp just in time to see Mr. Muldoon trying to unstick an axe from the stump in which he had embedded it the night before. Even in the shadowy dimness of moonlight, I could see the look of surprise and horror wash over Mr. Muldoon's face as I rushed toward him for protection. He emitted a strangled cry and rushed off through the woods on legs so wobbly it looked as if his knees had come unhinged. Under the circumstances, I could only surmise that the bear was close on my heels, and I raced off after Mr. Muldoon, unable to think of anything better to do. With his abrupt departure, Mr. Muldoon had clearly let it be known that now it was every man for himself. Bounding over a log with the effortless ease that accompanies total panic, I came upon Mr. Muldoon peeling bark and limbs off a small tree. Since he was only 4 feet up the tree, I debated briefly whether to wait for him to gain altitude or to find my own tree. Then Mr. Muldoon caught sight of the bear closing fast on us. He sprang out of the tree and took off again, with me so close behind that I could have reached out and grabbed the snapping flap of his long underwear. The thought did occur to me to do so because I was nearing exhaustion, and Mr. Muldoon could have towed me along with his underwear flap. Upon later reflection, however, I think it is well that I didn't grab the flap, for it probably would have been a source of considerable embarrassment to both of us. When I could run no more, I dropped to the ground, deciding I might as well let the bear eat me as run me to death. But the bear was gone. Perhaps he had taken a shortcut through the woods, hoping to cut me and Mr. Muldoon off at a pass. In any case, I never did get to see the bear, narrow as my escape had been. Sweltering in the fur coat, I took the thing off and stuffed it down a hollow stump, glad to be rid of the thing. When I got back to camp, everyone was gone. I climbed up to the car, inside of which I found Eddie, his mother, and Goomba, each more or less in one piece. "Thank heavens," cried Mrs. Muldoon. "We thought the bear had got you. Have you seen Mr. Muldoon?" I said yes, I had, not mentioning that I had even seen even more of him than I cared to. Half an hour later, Mr. Muldoon scrambled up the bank to the car. Upon learning that everyone was intact, he explained how he had led the bear away from camp at considerable risk to himself. I was surprised that he neglected to mention my role in leading the bear off, but didn't think it my place to mention it. "You gotta keep a cool head during a bear attack," Mr. Muldoon explained. "Panic and you're done for." "Ooh-wee," Goomba said. "I smell skunk. Somebody step on a skunk in the dark?" Then it started to rain. Hard. You've been listening to me read The Night the Bear Ate Goomba by Patrick McManus. And I made it without laughing hysterically through it. I hope you enjoy that story. This is Ms. G bringing you Left Hanging, and I'll be right back. Stay tuned. Hi there, this is Ms. G, and I am back bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 Juneau, Alaska. Hope you enjoyed that last story, The Bear That Ate Goomba by Patrick and Rannis. I have another quick, short one. At least I hope it's quick. Hope it's short. by Patrick McManus. It's titled Pigs. Wretch Sweeney, Al Finley, and I were returning from a fishing trip in Finley's new station wagon when we saw the crudely lettered sign nailed to the gatepost of a ramshackle farm. Pigs. $7. Holy mackerel, Wretch said. Did you see that? Pigs for only $7. Just keep driving, Finley mumbled peevishly. Exhausted, irritable, and still shivering from a little tumble he had taken into the river, he had ordered me to drive us home while he sprawled pouting on the rear seat. He claimed Wretch had bumped him off the log on purpose. Still, the drop into the river couldn't have been more than 15 feet at most. Also, from Finley's long, quavering screech, you might have supposed he had fallen off the Matterhorn. Also, if he had just relaxed and collected his senses, he would have realized that there was no point in trying to swim upstream in rapids, thus saving himself a lot of wasted effort. The waterfall he went over was nothing to brag about either, but typically, Finley had to create practically a major drama before he was swept over the brink. I think what irritated him the most, though, was Wretch's yelling. Stop thrashing about, Finley, you're scaring all the fish. That, of course, was inconsiderate of Wretch and even untrue, because I caught a nice rainbow just a few seconds after Finley washed by me. Pigs for $7 a piece, Wretch cried. Stop the car. Listen to me, I got an idea. Well, miracles never cease, Finley grumbled. Here's what we'll do, Wretch went on. You guys buy 2 pigs for each of us. That's 2 times 3 times 7, which comes to $42, I said, since I didn't want to grow old waiting for Wretch to work out the arithmetic. That's right, Wretch said. So here's what we'll do. You guys buy the pigs and I'll raise them. Then come fall, we'll have them turned into smoked hams and bacon and sausage. Doesn't that sound good? What's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of, I said. Wait a second, Finley said, using a shrewd tone. You mean next fall I end up with 2 full-grown hogs for a total price of $21? You'll do all the work and pay all the costs of raising them, Sweeney? Yeah, Wretch said. I'll just gather up all the spoiled food the supermarkets throw away. You won't cost me nothing except maybe for some grain. Sounds good to me, Finley said. But we can't haul 6 pigs in my station wagon. You'll have to come back and get them with a truck or a trailer. That's over 200 miles round trip, Wretch said. We got to take them now. What we'll do, see, is fold down the back seat. They'll just be little pigs so we can tie them up in gunny sacks, no problem. Well, okay, Finley said, ever alert for a bargain. I just don't want pigs messing up my car. My own reluctance remained intact. Unlike Wretch and Finley, I had had actual experience with pigs. I was but 7 years old when my friend Crazy Eddie Muldoon asked me if I wanted to ride one of his family's pigs. Why not, I said, never wanted to spend much time contemplating consequences. We walked out to the pig pen, and Eddie pointed to 3 huge hogs snoozing in the odorous mire. That one's Champ, next him is Trigger, and the biggest one, that's Silver. Oh, Silver, he'll give you the best ride, because I ain't broke him yet. Just climb up on the fence there and plop down on Silver's back and grab him by the ears. You can be the Lone Ranger and I'll be Tonto. Which one is Tonto going to ride, I asked. Tonto ain't going to ride. He's going to sit here on the fence and keep a lookout for my paw. Caught up in my anticipation of trotting about on Silver, I had forgotten about that standard precaution. 90% of the things Eddie and I did required keeping a lookout for his paw. I climbed the fence and plopped down on Silver's back, grabbing him by the ears in a single smooth movement, and started my Lone Ranger yell, high in 1 second flat. 200 pounds of furious pork sizzled around the pen like a piece of ice on a hot griddle. Champ and Trigger joined in the general ruckus, but without anywhere near the enthusiasm of Silver. I quickly tired of the ride and began looking for a way to dismount, finally deciding that the next time Silver tried to scrape me off on the fence, I would make a jump for it. Intelligent beings that pigs are, however, Silver made a few quick calculations in elementary physics, arriving at the conclusion that if he was to stop suddenly, Whatever was on his back would continue on at the same momentum until the pull of gravity counteracted the original force. He instantly put this theory to the test, and with great success. The hog sudden stop launched me like a torpedo off his back and sent me streaking headfirst through 6-inch deep residue of pig. I got up and shook as much of the muck off as I could, carefully wiping a couple of eye holes so I could see. Tonto sat unperturbed on the fence, nibbling a straw as he studied the situation. Without speaking to him, I climbed out of the pen and headed for the creek. I knew what Tonto wanted to say, that it was building up in him, demanding to be said, because an opportunity like this might never arise again in his lifetime. But I was a safe distance away, but not so far that I couldn't make out the words uttered in a small, pleased voice. He said it. Who was that masked man, anyway? From that moment on, I never had any use for pigs. They had left a bad taste in my mouth. I don't want to have anything to do with pigs, I told Wretched Finley. They're nothing but trouble. No trouble for you and me, though, Finley said. We won't even see them again until they're hams and bacon. He had a point there. I swung the car around and we drove back to the farm. A grizzled little man came out of the house picking his teeth and rubbing his rounded belly as though he had just finished a large dinner. Let me handle this, Finley said out of the corner of his mouth. This guy looks like a sharpie. That $7 sign was probably just a come-on. Guy probably thinks he's lured some dumb city slickers into his snare. Ha! I was glad we had a shrewd person like Finley along to handle the deal. Howdy, the farmer said. Expect you fellas want to buy some pigs. Might be, Finley said, if the price is right. The farmer appeared a little puzzled, and I could see that Finley had got in a deft stroke. If you've seen the sign, you've seen the price, the farmer said. $7. Uh-huh, Finley said shrewdly. Now, we're not talking about the runts of the litter, are we? We're talking good, healthy pigs. Yep, the farmer said. He pointed to a large fenced area where about 50 little pigs ambled about. There they are. You can take your pick. Well, that seems fair enough, Finley said. You got a deal. We'll take 6 pigs. Good. That'll be $42. I'll throw in some gunny sacks for free to haul them in. Finley handed him the money. The farmer counted it and tucked it into the bib pocket of his overalls. They're your pigs now, he said. Go catch the ones you want. We have to catch them ourselves? Finley asked. How do we do that? Don't know, the farmer said, turning to walk back to his house. Ain't none of them been caught yet. But you fellas might be faster than most folks. I don't suppose you'd be interested in buying the pigs back, Finley said, now more nervous and shrewd. Nope, I already got a surplus of pigs. Our first tactic consisted of each of us selecting a pig and trying to run him until he tired out. But all the pigs looked pretty much alike. So when one of the chase pigs got tired, he would charge into the crowd of other pigs, and a fresh pig would race out the other side, so that we were competing individually against what amounted to a pig relay. Another problem was the pig stood only about a foot high on all fours. When we closed in on one, we had to run stooped over in order to catch it. The posture not unlike that of a person doing a toe-touching exercise while sprinting. After an hour of this fruitless or pigless effort, we met for a consultation. I think we should all three of us concentrate on one pig at a time, I said. That way we can run it into a corner, grab the bleep of a bleep, and dump it into a gunny sack. Good idea, Reg said. Now can any of us straighten up enough to hold the sack? I can raise my hands to my knees, Finley said. Close enough, I said. You hold the sack. Only a few minutes after midnight, we cornered the 6 of our pigs and sacked them. We folded down the back seat of Finley's station wagon, spread out a couple of plastic rain slickers, dumped our sacks of little porkers on them, and headed for home. I still say it's cheap hams and bacon, Rich said, his body still curled in the shape of a question mark. What say, Finley?
I say, ow, ow, my aching back. That's what I say. And I better never lay eyes on these pigs until they are hams and bacon.
You got nothing to fear, Red said, thereby proving his inadequacy as a prognosticator. The pigs apparently contented their gunny sacks, occasionally emitted a quizzical grunt, but otherwise caused no commotion. Red and Finley dozed off, I hung on the steering wheel, sucking in occasional drags from a vacuum bottle of cold coffee to keep my eyelids from sneaking shut. After half an hour or so, we hit the freeway and had a straight shot home. Tired and aching, I paid little attention to a scuffling noise behind me. Suddenly on the back of my neck, I felt a moist snout, bristly little whiskers, and a hot panting breath. I must have been dreaming with my eyes open because for a second I thought it was my old high school girlfriend, Olga Bone Marrow. Yep, Olga Bone Marrow. I quickly realized, however, that the cause of these sensations wasn't chewing bubblegum, which ruled out Olga. "A pig's loose," I yelled. "Ye gads," Finley said. "He's off the rain slickers, too. Don't scare him. If he does anything on the carpeting, I'll kill him now with my bare hands." Alas. The shrill tone of Finley's voice prompted the pig to commit an act of hygienic indiscretion, right on the station wagon's new carpeting. Even as the culprit stood blinking his little pig eyes at his would-be assassin, the resulting wail from the carpeting's owner sent the pig tearing about the rear of the station wagon in a frenzy almost equal to that of Finley. This alerted the other prisoners to the festivities, and in a matter of seconds they had torn loose from their sacks and joined in the bedlam. The hysterical squealing was deafening. "Would you please stop squealing, Finley?" I said. "You're giving me a headache." "Stop the car," Finley ordered. "We've got to get the pigs back in the sacks." "Shucks," Rhett said sleepily. "They won't hurt nothing, Finley. You can hose up the back of the station wagon tomorrow and it'll be good as new. Let the little porkers have their fun." "I said stop the car." "I can't stop," I said. "You can only stop on the freeway if you have an emergency. You know that, Finley. Now calm down." "Then somebody's got to climb back there and stuff the pigs back in the sacks." "Be my guest," Reg said. "Oh, good heavens, I should know better than to hang out with you nitwits," Finley said, climbing into the back and grabbing at a pig. The station wagon rocked and swayed as Finley thrashed about, stuffing pigs in the sacks, only to have them escape when he lunged after another one. I turned up the radio in an effort to drown out the hideous sounds. Distracted as I was, and possibly because of strong motivation to end the drive as quickly as possible, I pressed down on the accelerator pedal a bit too hard. At that moment, a pig leaped over my shoulder and into my lap, only to be pursued by a sweating, snarling Finley who dragged the squalling beast over my face and into the back. The car swerved. No sooner had I got it back under control than a pulsing blue light filled the interior of the vehicle, followed by the wail of a state patrolman's siren rising ever so slightly above the din of Finley and the pigs. "Cripes," Rich said. "Now you gone and done it, Finley." A fragrant hush fell over our little group as I pulled the station wagon to the edge of the road and stopped. The patrolman walked cautiously up to my lowered window, his right hand resting on the unbuttoned flap of his holster. The man knew a wild bunch when he saw one. "I can explain, officer," I said, handing him my driver's license. "I bet," he said, not at all friendly. "Had a bit too much to drink, right, sir?" "Haven't had a drop," I replied. "I'm waiting until I get home to have too much to drink." "Oh, yeah? Well, let me just take a whiff of the inside of your vehicle, sir." "Oh, whoa, way!" Choke and gag. He staggered back, barely catching his balance and almost falling into the ditch. "As I tried to explain, officer," I said, "we have a man in back here trying to stuff pigs in sacks, and..." "That's enough of that, pal. I don't put up with what..." The patrolman flicked the beam of his flashlight in the back of the station wagon. Six pigs and Finley returned his stare. Smiling weakly, Finley held up a gunny sack, apparently as proof that he was engaged in a legitimate activity. "You see," I continued, "what happened was..." Okay, stop explaining," the patrolman said. "I'll let you off this time, but don't ever let me catch you guys driving while stuffing pigs in sacks again." "Rest assured, officer," I said, "you never will." Seldom have I ever been so confident in one of my predictions. I've been reading you The Pigs by Patrick F. McManus. This has been Ms. G bringing you Left Hanging, and until next time, good night.